Our next speaker is Assistant Professor of Surgery, Dr. Alexander Hawkins, who's at Vanderbilt University. And he'll be speaking on now talking about complicated diverticulitis.
Hi, good morning. First, thanks to Jason and Paul for the opportunity to talk with you this morning. And thank you all for your attention. I'm going to be talking about complicated diverticular disease management in the complicated patient. For disclosures, I have no financial disclosures. I do receive funding from the NIH to do research on diverticulitis. And also, complicated diverticulitis is complicated. And to attempt to explain all the nuances of the management of this disease in 15 minutes is a lot. Also, I tried to keep my talk fairly high level. There is some data presented, but most of it is helpful, hopefully helpful to you in your management of these patients. I'm going to be talking about first what is complicated diverticulitis versus uncomplicated diverticulitis. From that, I'm going to talk about when we go to the operating room. And then I'm going to talk about later indications for surgery. And finally, kind of the meat of my talk is going to be uncomplicating the complicated patient. So how do we make our lives better, our lives easier, and the patient's recovery better? So this usually comes in about 5 o'clock on a Friday evening. 52-year-old male, BMI of 52, tobacco abuse, diabetes on insulin here with diverticulitis and free air. Please come and assess. So even just reading this makes me cringe, but hopefully today I'll offer some opportunities how to deal with this patient and make our lives, both ours and the patient's, better. So first, what is complicated diverticular disease? Essentially, it's diverticulitis, inflammation of the diverticula, plus something else. And that plus can be an abscess, it can be a phlegmon, perforation, fistula, obstruction, or bleeding. I'm not going to really touch so much on bleeding today. I'm going to focus rather on the first five. Diagnosis. Diagnosis is best made with a CT scan with IV contrast. If you are concerned about some sort of fistula, you can use rectal contrast. That can also show you stricturing in the sigmoid colon as well. I did want to briefly touch on the Hinchey classification for perforated diverticulitis. Stage one is a pericolic abscess. Stage two is a larger pelvic abscess. Stage three, you have pus throughout the abdomen. In stage four, you have perforation throughout the abdomen. And you can see that your risk of death increases as you step up in the Hinchey classifications. This is also just important because a lot of times radiologists will report what level of, what stage of Hinchey comes with the perforated diverticulitis. So the big question, you go down to see this patient in the emergency department, do they need to go to the operating room? And I would make the argument that this really needs to be driven by the physiology of the patient. First, you need to ask yourself, is there an abscess you can drain? This should be the first step. Second question is, can they tolerate observation? And the way that kind of I put together the patient is a number of different things. One, I think tachycardia is a big indication of their systemic inflammation response. Two, are they hypotensive? This can also show that they are septic and they're having poor end-organ perfusion. Lactate and base deficit are also very helpful in looking at this. The degree of perforation, if you have a Hinchey class 3 or 4, it's very unlikely you're going to be able to manage that patient non-operatively, although Amy's going to talk a little bit about how we can do some minimally invasive techniques for that patient. And then I think one of the most important things is the patient factor. Can they tolerate observation? And what plays into this are things like age. Do they have existing comorbidities? Are they immunosuppressed? Are they someone who has coronary artery disease, COPD? Are they going to be able to tolerate a period of time where their body is ramped up and inflamed? And if they can't, you know, it's kind of paradoxical, but sometimes the sicker they are, the more important it is to take them to the operating room. So let's say you do decide to go to the operating room. You're there. You resect your big inflammatory sigmoid colon. And the question comes up, how do you finish this operation? In 2012, Annals of Surgery published a randomized controlled trial where they took 62 patients, Hinchey 3 and 4, so these are patients with free perforation of their sigmoid, and they randomized them to either a primary anastomosis with a diverting loop ileostomy or a Hartman's procedure. And what they found was that there was no difference in mortality or morbidity between the two groups, but there was a higher stoma reversal in the primary anastomosis with diverting loculiostomy. And I think this just goes to show that we are safe in doing a primary anastomosis and in diverting loculiostomy. And then in the long term, that'll offer less morbidity for the patient in terms of getting them free of their stoma sooner. I also wanted to say one thing. If you are taking a patient to the operating room for complicated diverticulitis, you want to save your splenic flexure. So this is important because you're going to come back, or somebody else is going to come back in 3 to 6 months and try and put this patient back together. And to get a tension-free anastomosis, you really want to save your splenic flexure. And I know, Paul, if they are very, very fat, sometimes you do need to take it down to get the ostomy out. So I will agree with you there. All right. So your patient, you decide that they don't need acute surgery. You go through the management of antibiotics and bowel rest. What are the later indications for surgery for complicated diverticulitis? And it mainly boils down to three things. The first is a stricture. The second is a fistula. And the third is persistent symptoms. And you need to be very careful about inflammatory bowel disease in these patients. All these patients should undergo colonoscopy as there's about a 4% risk of cancer or other pathology in patients who have had complicated diverticulitis. Persistent symptoms may range from persistent suprapubic or left lower quadrant abdominal pain, difficulty evacuating their bowels, and kind of under generalized symptoms which keep them coming back to your office. So now kind of one thing I want to talk about is uncomplicating the complicated patient. And I view this really in two different spheres. One is medical and the other is surgical. So how can we make our lives easier and how can we make our outcomes better with the patient and how can we make our lives easier in the operating room? Obesity. So I did my general surgery training in Boston and I thought I knew what obesity was. And then I moved to Middle Tennessee and I truly learned what obesity was. So with my patients who are coming to me with complicated diverticulitis and are interested in a resection and who are obese, the first thing we do in my first meeting is we set a target weight. Again, and this depends on your practice, but it's good to say, I think you are appropriate for an operation, but I think it's too risky to do unless you get to X. That holds both of you all accountable. I think it's a little bit cruel just to say that and not offer them any help, so I generally refer them to a nutritionist to help with their weight loss. And I also think in these patients, too, it's important if you can to utilize a minimally invasive approach in your operation to help with outcomes. Medical comorbidities, diabetes, you want to check a hemoglobin A1C and make sure that their diabetes is well controlled. You also want to leverage whoever is managing their diabetes as well, be it their PCP or their endocrinologist. For patients with coronary artery disease, you want to go through the risk stratification and optimization with either their PCP or their cardiologist. And a really good place that I generally find myself flipping back to, even during clinic, is the ACC and AHA guidelines. I have them bookmarked on my computer. COPD, pulmonary consult, and you really want to put these folks on an exercise regimen to make sure that they are in really good shape for their surgery. Frailty. Frailty is getting talked more and more about outcomes after surgery. Basically, we know that frailty predicts mortality, complications, and institutional discharge after surgery. I am by no means an expert in frailty, but I generally, what I do to evaluate it in my clinic is I make sure that I have my nurses place the patient in a chair. And when it comes time to examine them, I observe whether they can get up from their chair and move to the exam table or not. And that's just a really good simple litmus test at how frail they are. And then you can kind of do further testing from that. I use geriatrics consults on patients that I believe have a high degree of frailty. And then also engaging physical therapy for prehabilitation prior to surgery has been shown to improve outcomes after surgery for the frail. Malnutrition, and it's important to ask about weight loss. 10% weight loss is an indication of at least moderate malnutrition. You also want to check an albumin, a prealbumin, and if it's less than 3.5 or less than 16, they will receive the diagnosis of malnutrition. I encourage supplements in almost all my patients with malnutrition, and I also make sure that they get a nutrition referral. Also, I wanted to put a plug in. The American College of Surgeons has a new program called Strong for Surgery, and it goes through a lot of improving nutrition, improving preoperative strength and conditioning prior to surgery, and it's a good resource out there for all of us. Smoking. So some of the best data we have that smoking increases your morbidity by 30% and increases your mortality by 50%. Generally, the best data says that we want at least 8 weeks prior to surgery for our patients to stop smoking. There have been a number of studies that show if they're within that 8-week time period, that it may not be as efficacious. But there's also a myth that it actually increases postoperative complications if they stop smoking within 8 weeks, and that's just categorically not true. So if you can, get them to stop smoking at least 8 weeks before, but it's fine if they stop within that time. Use your smoking cessation resources. And you can use urinary cotinine testing to evaluate whether they've actually stopped or not. So immunosuppressed transplant patients, we're talking about steroids, not these. In some ways, and I think in the previous talk it got alluded to, patients who are immunosuppressed can be an indication for surgery in and of themselves. They have poor wound healing, so they're unable to really be in that group that you can watch. They can't really heal their diverticulitis, and they're also at risk for further complications with further episodes. You also want to work with your transplant team pre-op to optimize them. So now that we've kind of medically optimized our patients, we're going to talk about optimizing our operating room. So you really want to find some urologists that you get along well with, because they can be your best friend with these surgeries. Any patient who's had complicated diverticulitis that I take to the operating room, I have them place bilateral ureteral stents. One of my mentors always would say that if you want peace, prepare for war. You can also engage your urologist to bladder repair and then postoperative Foley drainage. We usually keep our Foleys in for about 5 to 7 days if we do anything with the bladder. Lap versus open, it really depends on your skill set. If you're skilled laparoscopically, I think it's appropriate to approach these patients. And I've also divided this slide up into the data for acute and elective surgery. For acute, the largest Cochrane systematic review shows that there's no difference in length of stay or complication rates when you approach a patient with minimally invasive techniques, and that there's a possible improvement in pain and quality of life. For elective surgery, there's an NIS paper from 2014 which showed that 68% of our elective sigmoid colectomies for diverticular disease are being done laparoscopic now. That similar paper showed that the decrease in morbidity from 26 to 14 with the laparoscopic approach, and a decrease in mortality as well. And I also think that there's no prospective randomized trials for this, but we can look at the color trial data, which compared laparoscopic to open colon cancer resection, and they saw earlier recovery of bowel function, need for fewer analgesics, and a shorter hospital stay. If you do need to divert your patients, either with a colostomy or an ileostomy, it's really important to mark them preoperatively. So engage your wound ostomy care nurses early. You want to consider diversion, especially for patients with immunosuppression, malnutrition, and abscess. And then this right here is the ostomy triangle. Its boundaries are the ASIS on the left and right, the pubic tubercle, and the umbilicus. You want to be placing your ostomy somewhere in the rectus in this triangle. This will place it in an easy position for the patient to use it. It'll also keep it below their belt line. And most importantly, it'll keep it from, by putting it through the rectus, you really reduce your risk of peristomal hernias. So in conclusion, let the patient in front of you guide the need to operate or not. And then try and make these surgeries as easy as possible. Modify the patient, modify the surgery. This is my both Twitter and my email address. If you'd like copies of my slides, I'd be happy to share them with you. And I look forward to answering any of your questions.